Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, October 23rd, 2020. Working from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is producer Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. As we get going today, game three tonight of the World Series, you're going to have the Dodgers and the Rays. Walker Buehler starting for the Dodgers against Charlie Morton of the Rays. And we're going to get into that matchup. But first, some notes from around baseball. Yesterday, the Players Association announced their Players' Choice Awards. Minnesota Twins DH Nelson Cruz was voted Marvin Miller Man of the Year. Atlanta Braves first baseman Freddie Freeman was picked as Player of the Year. Freeman was also voted the National League's Outstanding Player. Trevor Bauer won Outstanding Pitcher in the National League. San Diego infielder Jake Cronenworth was named Outstanding Rookie. And Colorado pitcher Daniel Bard is the National League Comeback Player of the Year. The Chicago White Sox first baseman Jose Abreu was the AL's Outstanding Player. Shane Bieber, naturally, named the Outstanding Pitcher in the AL. Kyle Lewis, the Outstanding Rookie. And Cleveland pitcher Carlos Carrasco was named Comeback Player of the Year. The Washington Nationals re-signed infielder Josh Harrison to a one-year, $1 million contract. I'll say it again. Guys who settle on deals quickly this offseason are going to be happier because there are going to be a lot of free agents out there waiting a long time for jobs, given what we're going to see in the winter market. The teams, the Rays and the Dodgers, held off-day press conferences. Here's Dave Roberts talking about Walker Buehler.
I think probably he's talking. I think that just my time knowing Walker for all these years, he's just kind of easygoing always. And so I guess if he came in like Clayton on his start day, I would be a little bit more concerned. But Walker just kind of comes in and kind of ramps up his focus. But early on, he's just jovial.
Rays manager Kevin Cash talked about what sets Charlie Morton apart from other pitchers.
Well, the preparedness is one, but just his overall demeanor, the way, I mean, you've seen him now, you've covered him for 2 years. He's the same guy, whether it's game seven or game 30. And that's pretty comforting. And I think it's not just what Charlie does for himself. It's what he does for our club. It's pretty settling. We've seen it every outing we've given him the ball in the postseason for the last 2 years, he's been pretty outstanding. And when you build that type of a track record, you just continue to have so much confidence in the person. The stuff speaks for itself. And what he did in game seven, I think all season long, it was a little bit of a struggle for Charlie to maintain his stuff deep in games. Through 70 pitches or whatever it was, the stuff never wavered. And that gives us a lot of reason to feel positive that he's going to be able to go out there and give us every opportunity to win.
Here's Kevin Cash on Walker Buehler.
He's tough. A really, really talented pitcher. Just caught some highlights of what he's done. We'll watch some video today. Look, he's got the big fastball, similar to like Gerrit Cole. I'm not comparing him with Gerrit Cole, just saying that, with the fastball, the way he pitches at the top of the zone, the ride that he gets through the zone at 98 to 100 miles an hour, we got our hands full. But trust that our guys, can build and capitalize off what they did last night, get the momentum going at the plate, and just put some really challenging at-bats together.
Coming up on the podcast today, we're going to be talking to Jake Odorizzi, a longtime pitcher, and Chris Singleton, ESPN radio analyst, about Walker Buehler and Charlie Morton. Here's Charlie Morton discussing his mindset for facing the Dodgers in Game 3.
I think the recognition that the game is still the game and the environment is going to impact you mentally if you let it, positively or negatively. So I think that's the biggest thing. I don't think... like the guys over in the other clubhouse, it's the fact that they've been here several times in the past 4 years. The fact that their core group has remained intact, the leaders on their team have been there now for a few years. They look comfortable out there. They look like a team that has been here before, and that makes them dangerous.
Here's Walker Buehler talking about the unpredictable Rays lineup.
Probably more their approach than anything. Obviously, they're going to kind of move guys around and, more of a manufacturing team as opposed to a pure slugging team, I guess, like Atlanta may be. So I think the other thing is you never really know exactly what lineup you're going to get. It's not a consistent every single day, six, seven, eight guys that play every day. So just kind of trying to figure out what you think they may do against you and work off of that.
Rob Manfred, baseball's commissioner, was on Baseball Tonight the other day, and he was asked about whether or not a runner at second base in extra innings is a rule that's going to stick around as baseball moves into 2021 and beyond.
I will say, of the COVID-related changes, it's the one that seems to have the most traction in the game. You know, the players seem to like it. It, you know, brings a more kind of definitive end to the game, eliminates those really long extra inning games, and the fans seem to like it. The strategy's interesting. So I think it does have some traction in the game.
He was asked about the economic state of the league.
The clubs in total lost about $2.7, $2.8 billion in cash. I mean, it's a tremendous hit. They did a nice job in terms of preserving liquidity, handling the losses. We're going to have an offseason where the market's going to operate, but obviously it was a very difficult year financially for the clubs.
He was asked about the status of labor negotiations with the player association with that deal set to expire in December 2021.
Labor relations is an ongoing relationship. Like any ongoing relationship, you have tough moments and you have good moments. I'm glad that we were able to make agreements that allowed us to do things like move into the bubble here for the postseason, and I hope it portends good things for the future.
Now, before we get to Jake Odorizzi, Chris Singleton, and Todd Radom with his weekly quiz, check out season 2 of ESPN Investigates. The Running Man tells the story of an obscure former Olympian and alleged serial sexual predator and how a 14-month ESPN investigation brought him out of the shadows. More than 50 men were physically abused and mentally manipulated by their coach over 40 years until they banded together decades later to find justice. Subscribe and listen now to ESPN Investigates wherever you get your podcasts.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code baseball. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Jake Odorizzi is a longtime pitcher in the major leagues. He was a 2019 American League All-Star. And Jake, your last year with the Tampa Bay Rays was in 2017. What's it like watching them play in the World Series, you know, knowing some of those guys?
Yeah, it's one of those things like, all right, well, I did with Kansas City as well, too. I was there and then left there in the World Series, so I got to see a lot of those guys make it. So this is kind of like my second time going through it, but you know, honestly, my time in Tampa, there's only about two guys from the team that are still on that team with Kiermaier and Snell. So it's a little bit different feeling because a lot of those guys are guys I didn't even play with. But it's good to see, you know, for the other people that are still there from the coaching staff, the clubhouse staff, the front office. Eric Neander's done a really good job of, you know, crafting that team with all the limitations that they have in place for themselves. So it's good for the organization as a whole to kind of get back to it. And they put in a lot of hard work that's got them in this position and had a lot of trades, you know, work out for them. And that's kind of what they have to do to be successful. And I think it's all kind of culminated and come together for them.
So tell me about Kevin Kiermaier, who I've gotten to know through the years. He's one of my favorite people to talk to, in part because of his passion about defense. You know, I told this story on the podcast, I think it was last week, about it. You know, going to spring training in Charlotte, in Port Charlotte, and having a conversation with Kevin in the morning about defense and going out and watching him shag. and he's running like a madman all around center field. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. It's batting practice and spring training, and he's running all over the place. Logan Morrison's swinging a bat, and Kevin's catching everything, line drives, and Logan finally hits a ball over the fence and yells out at Kiermaier, "Catch that, you blank." And everyone just cracks up. He has such passion for playing defense.
He really does. And I think he knows that that's his calling card. He's a game changer on the defensive side. He's got a great arm to go with that. So for him, honing his craft, he uses every possible time to get better. So you can work on getting reads in center field, you know, BP. You know, during the game, you really don't get too much time to work on your defense. So you have to use that time as, you know, batting practice, early work, whatever it may be, to get yourself the work that you feel like you need to be prepared for the game. And for a guy who really is passionate about his defense and cares about it, he works extremely hard at it. Just like you said, it's 10 in the morning, spring training. Sometimes the energy level is a little bit low, and you have a guy who's utilizing his time as best he can. So he's prepared or trying to get better at something maybe that day he was wanting to work on, you know, first step or whatever it may be. So there's a lot of things that he likes to work on. And I've been very fortunate to have him as my center fielder. Then when I was traded to Minnesota, I have Byron Buxton as my center fielder. So I have arguably the two best center fielders in the game as my center fielder since about 2014 and on. So I've been pretty fortunate over the years.
Jake, last year I had a conversation with Eric Neander about the Rays philosophy, and the way he described it, it absolutely turned on a light bulb for me about the perspective that the Rays have. And I think the Dodgers have this as well, because Andrew Friedman took it from the Rays over to the Dodgers. And Eric said to me when we were talking about, you know, payroll differences, which the Rays are always going to have one of the lowest payrolls and draft picks. And he said, you know what? The organization's greatest asset is not payroll size. The greatest asset is not where your draft picks are. The greatest asset is all of those plate appearances and all of those innings that give you an opportunity to help a player get better. And it's pretty clear from, you know, the way that they've made guys better. And I think a guy like Mike Brasso is an example, that's how they live it day to day. Okay, let's find a guy with a particular skill and try to hone that skill and turn him into a really useful player. Was that reflective of what you saw when you were over there?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way of putting it. They have a system. They like to get guys that maybe aren't viewed at as, you know, the same by every organization. I think everybody, you know, every organization values guys differently, but I feel like they're a little more in depth with who they kind of target, you know, not only drafting but free agent signs, like non-draft and free agent signs. They've been pretty successful on a lot of those guys. So I think the character is a big thing to them. They like clubhouse chemistry to be up there, because, you know, if you're the Rays and you're limited financially, you have to be able to draw people to, you know, buy into being to Tampa or making it look like a destination. So they've always had a good clubhouse chemistry with teammates that they tried to bring in, coaching staff. It's always been fun then. I think that's what, you know, they built themselves on, because, you know, if you're there's no organization in general, but just say you're a low budget organization and it's a very strict, you know, you have to do this, you have to do that type of a thing, I don't think it works out too well. So they've adapted way before that to allow everybody to be themselves, not feel the pressure of, you know, maybe some organizational philosophies that other teams have. And it really lets guys kind of come into their own and relax and make the most out of their players. So, you know, they've been successful with trades over the years. We've seen that. I think mine might be the only one that they haven't really crushed it on. So I guess I should wear that as like a little feather in my cap. But other than that, it seems like everything they've done has worked out. And I think for them, that's what they have to do to be successful. When you have a limited payroll that you need, like, the perfect storm to come together, over years of preparation.
I'm going to ask you in a moment about the matchup in Game 3, which is a fun matchup of different styles and personalities, Charlie Morton and Walker Buehler. But I want to ask you about some of what's been discussed this week by Commissioner Rob Manfred about future rule changes, or the question of whether or not they're going to continue some of the stuff that we saw in baseball in 2020. And I just want to get your feel on what you think about these particular rules. First off, universal designated hitter. I think there's a perception generally that the two sides, Player Association, Major League Baseball, will eventually come to an agreement to have that move forward. How do you feel about the universal DH?
Kind of indifferent. I've been in the American League my whole career, so I'm just a face of the DH, you know, up and down the lineup. So it really changes nothing. But selfishly, like, I still enjoy hitting. I may not be that good at it, but I know it's not very fun to watch pitchers hit. But I still selfishly enjoy going up there and, you know, and hitting when we play interleague. But I realize the value that it brings to the game. And a lot of players, like, I've played with one of the best in Nelson Cruz these last 2 years. And, you know, I think we really got to see him at age 40, still how well he can perform. So there's opportunities for guys like that to prolong their career and do it at a high level. So, you know, it really doesn't change anything for me. I mean, I've been well acclimated to the DH over the years. So it's, that one would be something that I'd be okay with. But as we all know, there's negotiations to be had on literally just about everything when it comes to these things. And we all know how those tend to go. So hopefully it gets addressed at some point in a relatively mild manner.
How do you feel about the efforts to truncate games, extra innings, by placing a runner at second base in the 10th inning, or let's say 11th or 12th or whatever they come up with? How do you feel about that?
I could go either way, to be quite honest. I'd be fine with it. I'd be fine without it. It's typically not a situation where I'm involved in. It's just more or less getting the game to be shortened, saving arms, potentially getting the game over sooner. But I know a lot of times those relievers that have to come in to pitch those innings, it's much more difficult on them to just sit here and, all right, I got a guy on second base. It's time to, you know, be in a high leverage situation. So that's one of the ones, if it goes one way, I'd be fine. If they said we're going back to the old way, I'd be fine with that as well.
Seven inning games went in cases of doubleheaders, which was used a lot this year as baseball dealt with some of these coronavirus outbreaks, postponements.
As a starter, I kind of like it because you can potentially save the bullpen, get a little rest. But I was, you know, hearing it from the bullpen perspective, we were chatting about it during the year, and, you know, some guys made a good point of it takes away potentially, you know, innings for relievers. And we all know that, you know, if you have a guy that's an incentive based contract or whatever it is, holds opportunities, build stats, it takes that opportunity away from some relievers. And I hadn't really even thought about it to that point. I was just thinking about, I was trying to save relievers and not getting people overworked in the nine inning, you know, doubleheader situation. But, you know, reliever wise, there's a lot of opportunities for guys to pitch in those situations. So, as a starter, I'm okay with it. If I was a reliever, I might feel differently about it. I guess that's the best way I can answer that.
This year, of course, because it was 2020, we had a 16-team playoff field. When Manfred spoke this week, he mentioned that, yeah, you might not have 16 teams again, but he does want an expanded playoff field. How do you feel about, say, 12 teams or 14 teams?
I think it's good for the opportunity that it presents teams. I mean, obviously the 60 games was a very unique one to make the playoffs, but you had teams that, you know, probably, I wouldn't say they wouldn't make the playoffs in a normal season. There's obviously a lot of extra spots and there's 100 more games we missed out on, but you're giving fan bases an opportunity to, you know, see their team in the postseason, which there's a lot of teams that hadn't seen it for quite a while. So that's always good for the game. You know, more teams that are in the mode of winning is good for baseball and good for players, good for fans, good for everything. So I think it's one of those things that if you create more spots, it might give teams more incentives to maybe push in a little bit more on, you know, free agency or making trades or, you know, signing their young players to keep them around longer because they want to build a base to make it to the postseason. So I think it's a good thing, personally, but that's just my opinion.
Folks, at the team level, when Rob first started talking about this about a month ago in an interview with the Associated Press, he seemed to indicate that he was open to a 16-team playoff field. And I can tell you, at the team level, folks were going crazy. Like, they were like, no, 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 can't do that. You need some more incentives built in for a team that has the best record or wins a division, you know, a first-round bye if you're the number one seed and not the exposure to the best of three. How do you feel about that?
I agree. There needs to be some tweaking to it. Just, you know, winning a division is special. And I think this year the importance of it wasn't, you know, nearly appropriate for what it normally is. you know, just to be in the, everybody had the 3-game series to open up. It's, there was really no difference if you won the division or if you were the 8th seed, the second wild card team. So, you know, there needs to probably be a little bit of tweaking to the system. And I'm sure they can figure that sort of thing out, because you do need something to provide the incentive of making a division important. And there's a huge advantage to winning a division. So, you know, from a player standpoint there, I agree that there needs to be some talk involved that says, you know, you get a bye, or there's, you know, I don't know, maybe you go back to a 1-game wild card for the lower teams and then you bring them in, you know, whatever it may be. I don't really know what all has been discussed or what could be discussed, but I definitely agree with that. There needs to be some more language in there that incentivizes and makes winning a division important.
So the Rays win game 2. Blake Snell throws well in the first part of the game, throws up a bunch of zeros. Brandon Lau hits a couple of home runs. How does that set up the rest of the series in your eyes, the fact that it's split now coming off an off day?
I think the important thing was the Brandon Lau game. I mean, he's really struggled in the postseason, and I think it's been well documented, but he's finally, you know, he had his 2 home runs, and to their credit, they've kept him at the top of the lineup this entire time, and he broke through. So now that, you know, they're arguably their best hitter finally has some footing underneath him, I think it makes it more interesting. And then you see, like, the Dodgers didn't go away. They scratched some runs across late, made it a close game, and, you know, that's just, I think that's the way the series is going to go. It's either, you know, the focus is going to be keeping the Dodgers offense kind of at bay, which Snell did a great job at the other day, and it put them in a good spot. They were able to get a lead early and hold on to that lead. So I think it's going to make for a really interesting series if both teams are firing on all cylinders to go the rest of the way.
Walker Buehler, explosive stuff. One of the best fastballs in baseball, starts for the Dodgers in game 3. And then you have the old pro, Charlie Morton, who turns 37 in a few weeks. In his last 9 appearances in the postseason, he has a 1.45 ERA. What do you see in this matchup?
This is one of the matchups you want to really tune into if you're a fan of baseball. Like, Walker's stuff is so electric, and he's fun to watch. He does a lot of things that, you know, that looks so natural and normal, but it's coming at like 99 and elite carry with, you know, plus breaking balls, and it's just, here it is, and he's going to challenge you, and I really like that as a pitcher. And then Charlie, he's incredible, man. He's fun to watch. I got to talk to him quite a bit at the All-Star game last year. He's just a very grounded pitcher, and he just enjoys the moment. He doesn't like take it like it's okay, I need to do better today because it's the playoffs. He is the same type of person every single game, and that's what's fun. He's got, like, you know, he's like cold-blooded out there. He doesn't react to anything. You know, he's going to go out there and give you exactly what you need, and he's gotten better as his career has gone on. So as a pitcher, you know, that's the guy that you look to, like, go in their footprints of as you start to age and get older. It's like, this guy's gotten better as he's gotten older. So there's a lot of confidence, I think, from Tampa's side when he's on the mound. And, you know, you really, if it comes to a game 7, you know who you want to pitch for you. If you're the Rays, you're going to put him back out there and let him, you know, pitch game 7 like he's done for the last couple of years.
So because you got to know a little bit, I'm going to tell you a story I've talked about on the podcast before and see if this makes sense to you because of your experience in chatting with him. A.J. Hinch, the former Astros manager, told this great story about how at the end of 2016, Charlie was coming off a rough season. Of course, he had a lot of injuries in his career and some rough seasons with the Pirates, but he's coming off a tough year. And the Astros come out of the gate at him hard in the negotiations, and they offer him a 2-year deal. And Charlie quickly agrees to it, you know, through his agent. And they sit down in the first meeting between the Astros staffers and Charlie. And the first question Charlie has for AJ and Jeff Luhnow, looking across the table, he goes, "Why would you give me a 2-year offer? Like, what, you know, how can you give me a 2-year offer? Like, I'm not very good," was kind of like his tone. Does that make sense, knowing Charlie?
Yes, it does. Like, from what I know and what I've heard about him, like, that's exactly the type of stuff that I've heard, which is, you know, honestly, a cool thing in today's game. It's like everyone's trying to, you know, maximize as much as they can. They want to get as much as they can, and they can tell you why they need it. And he's asking them, you know, why me? Why? What did I do to get this? Like, that's the type of pitcher you want on your team, honestly. Like, and then since he's got that deal, it's almost like it was a reset for him of, oh, okay, well, I've got guaranteed money now for, you know, roughly the first time in my career. I just can go out and pitch and go do it. And he's done it. So I think maybe that was a key to his success, is finally somebody believed in him and gave him something that he didn't even think was maybe right at the time. And he's really delivered ever since then. So maybe as a career, that's a big turning point for him, having that confidence that a team really is buying into him and likes what he does.
Yeah, it's really cool to see him have the success that he's had. All right, Jake, thanks for doing this, and enjoy the baseball over the weekend.
Absolutely, Buster. You too.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Chris Singleton is an analyst on ESPN Radio in this World Series, working alongside Dan Shulman and Jessica Mendoza. And Singy, I love what we got tonight, which is a good old-fashioned pitching matchup. Charlie Morton going up against Walker Buehler, pitchers with different styles, different personalities. What do you think?
I think this is the best matchup of the series that we're going to see. And what's pretty cool is, you know, here we are, game three. I know the Dodgers don't want to see a game seven. I think coming in, if you ask the Rays, hey, take a game seven right now, take it or leave it, I think they would say yes. And here's what we could have in a game seven as well. And reason being, I know we've heard a lot about, you know, Blake Snell, you know, Cy Young Award winner a couple of years ago, Tyler Glass now, you know, high-powered fastball. But it's really been Charlie Morton that has been the most consistent, the most effortless, you know, pitching against, you know, lineups like the New York Yankees, the Houston Astros, pretty tough lineup. So, you know, really, you know, he's the old man. Kevin Cash calls him a dad. He's kind of a dad to a lot of the guys on the team, but we know he's got a lot of postseason experience. It's been really good. So kind of cool that we get that up against the Dodgers. You know, their number one guy. I mean, Clayton Kershaw obviously is, you know, the longstanding, you know, ace, if you will, and had a great, you know, game one to this World Series, but, you know, all eyes are on Walker Buehler. So I think this is the treat that we get tonight, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, coming into this series, I picked the Dodgers in six, and they, you know, they had the blowout win in game one, and I thought they had a great matchup against Blake Snell in game two, but they lose and the Rays win. And I, you know, if they ask me my pick today, I feel like the pendulum has swung back the other way, where I think the Rays have an advantage that they got Charlie potentially in two of the last five games. And on top of that, their bullpen now all set and fortified by this off day. What's your read on it?
My read, Buster, is looking, you know, coming into the series and looking at particularly the way that Kevin Cash uses, you know, his arms, his bullpen, the way that he needs things to go. He doesn't have the margin for error that the Dodgers have. I've maintained that if you are, you know, one run up or tied with a team like, you know, the Dodgers, you're losing unless it's the ninth inning with an out or two, and you're closing the ball game out because of their ability to score, you know, quickly and score big. So, you know, looking at that, I look at where we were in game two. The Rays were down, 1-0 in the series. And we knew that, okay, Kevin Cash, given the opportunity, was going to be extremely aggressive the way that, you know, typically he's been. He got, you know, the high leverage arms into the game. Nick Anderson was in pretty early. He navigated to the finish line. I look at now, we're in a grouping of three games. Okay, so game one of this next little three games, if Kevin Cash is in a situation where he can be aggressive and dictate, I would imagine you'd want to do that in this game three, because then you give your relievers an opportunity maybe to get a break tomorrow and then be ready to go in game five with the same type of approach. So I'm kind of looking at beyond just, you know, game to game, but looking at how the Rays and Cash can possibly try to, you know, beat the Dodgers or even just push it to a game seven. And because the Dodgers clearly coming in are the favorites, but I think the Rays, if things go right, if they can manage even the little increments of the series properly, they've got a good chance to push it deep.
You played six seasons in the big leagues, and so you know what it means to go through ups and downs. Where do you think Brandon Lau's head is now after hitting those two home runs in game two?
Huge lift, just a huge lift off of his shoulders. He's a pretty low-key guy anyway, so you don't see the extremes. If you were to see a, you know, let's just say contrasting within his own team, a guy who's got a lot of personality, Willy Adames. You know, you see how he is. He's smiling. He's happy. So if he was down, you'd really, really notice. Whereas Brandon Lau, yeah, he's been down, but it's not like his upside is, you know, just this ball of joy. So, you know, we could see it wearing on him. But I think in clearly some of the post-game interviews, the smile that he was able to crack was a lot bigger. And, you know, I think that clearly the approach that he had in game two was a approach that, you know, can breed success, even though it's just a little short run here with, you know, possibly five more games. I think he can be on the right track. And if he is, that is going to be the difference that they need. They got by without him. They got by pretty much without Austin Meadows through the first, the division series and the championship series, but you're not going to beat the Dodgers if you don't have production from those guys, especially when you're batting them at the top of your order.
You did a lot of the broadcasts of the American League playoffs, so you saw the damage that Randy Rosarena was doing in the postseason. And then he goes into the World Series games one and two. The Dodgers threw him a total of five fastballs in the first two games. What do you make of their approach with him?
Yeah, it's smart. I mean, it's advanced scouting, right? The Dodgers have done, they've watched. We started to see the fastballs taper down, I think, with each round as a Rosarena was doing, you know, damage. And, you know, to his credit, seeing more breaking balls, when he did get a fastball, you know, he was pretty good about taking advantage of it. But that opportunity has continued to decrease. And especially when, you know, he's the guy circled in that lineup that can't let him beat us in a time where spinning the ball is great. Everything makes sense to approach him that way. It's just a matter of, for me, and having watched him, he's got power to all fields. You know, I'd say half of the home runs he's hit in this series have been to center right center field. So being able to trust that, you know, as a young hitter, that listen, I can recognize the pitch. I can, if I want to, in certain counts, maybe sit off speed and try to drive the ball to right center field. He may just run into one and hit it out again, but he's gone that way. So I think for him, it'd be important. I think, you know, the Rays definitely need him to be able to find a way to make an adjustment, or somebody hitting behind him is going to have to start doing some damage for him to get some pitches.
I love the stories you've told on radio about Cody Bellinger and how long you've known him. Just tell that story about the first time you met him and the first time you saw him with a bat in his hand.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not as surreal now, Buster, because I've had a couple of years to adjust to it. But I tell you, when Cody Bellinger, you know, arrived on the big league scene and really just impressing everyone, it was a real kind of awkward, surreal time for me because, you know, it was the first time, the first player that you look back and you say, gosh, that kid was essentially a baby, a toddler when I met him, when he used to come in the clubhouse playing in Columbus, Ohio for the Columbus Clippers, a AAA team for the New York Yankees. And Clay Bellinger, his dad, who was one of our catchers, utility guy, Jen, you know, Clay's wife, Cody's mom, they were there all the time. You know, families just like big leagues, they kind of wait outside the clubhouse. And, you know, being still a young guy myself, I wasn't even, I was married, but no kids, didn't even understand that world of it yet. And you'd see Clay's a guy that was kind of a journeyman. He's battling, he's trying to get to the big leagues, trying to do everything he can. There'd be times where, you know, playing time for him inconsistent, which, you know, wouldn't lead to success at times. And, you know, you'd see him have a tough game, man. And it's like, gosh, you know, this, how bad this guy wants to get there. You know, get the health insurance, get all those things that, you know, not being on the 40 man roster. Those are some of the things that, you know, minor league guys, you know, are looking for, man. I got a wife, I got kids. If I can get on the 40 man, I get big league insurance, all that. So you'd see some of these struggles at times, but never failed, you know, good game or bad game. Once the, you know, kids were kind of led into the clubhouse after, here comes Cody with his plastic bat. And he's just he had these eyes that were pleading and almost like crying to dad, we got to go down and hit. Like it's, there was no, like Clay had no like chance of not doing it because Cody's like, his eagerness to go hit was like off the charts. So Clay would go down still kind of half uniform and he just flip balls to his kid and his kid, Cody is his contact bat to ball skills were just like ridiculous. I mean, he would square up the ball just consistently. So, you know, he had some similarities between his batting stance now as he, then as he does now. So it's just kind of cool. But I mean, even, you know, when I still watch him, there's sometimes I can't believe it. I'm just like, wow, this is like your life flashes in front of your eyes, but still in touch with the family and, you know, get to kind of enjoy and celebrate some of the things that Cody's doing now from a distance, because there was so much separation over the years. But I'm a fan and a fan of the player, fan of the family.
All right, Singy. I love those stories. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for getting up.
Yeah, you got it. My pleasure. Talk to you tonight.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. And, of course, Todd, you have a book coming out, a hockey book, on November 3rd.
I do, Buster. It's called Fabric of the Game. It is the stories behind the names, the logos, and the uniforms of every team in the history of the National Hockey League, dating back to 1917. A little something different, but very excited for November 3rd to roll around because everybody's going to be focused on Fabric of the Game.
Exactly. That happens. For those who are totally locked into the baseball world, that is Election Day. All right. Before we get to this week's quiz, I wanted to ask you, one of the cool things that you have done every year since I've known you is you like to go to the All-Star Game and you like to go to the World Series. And let's set aside, because you're a Red Sox fan, let's set aside the 2004 Red Sox experience when they won their first World Series in 86 years. Besides that, tell me about your favorite memory of going to a World Series.
Wow, I got a couple of them, Buster. And of course, as you know, I've worked in baseball and in sports doing what I do, design and marketing, for 30 years now. So I go back to the very first one, which precedes that, and that is being a fan, going with my dad to game one of the 1977 World Series in the Bronx, Yankees-Dodgers. But since then, I think my favorite memory, I was hired by MLB to design a scorecard. Remember those things that fans actually filled out for the 1995 World Series? So I traveled back and forth between Atlanta and Cleveland. saw a great, great World Series. Really enjoyed it. And just real quick, I got a couple of other ones. Game 4 of the 93 World Series at the Vet in Philadelphia as a fan, sitting up in the 700 seats for that crazy 15-14 game Subway Series in New York. I got a ton of them, but you're right. I'm like a penned-in animal over here, it's kind of weird not to be traveling this time of the year, as you well know.
What's your favorite piece of memorabilia that you have from those trips?
Wow, I'm not a huge collectibles guy, Buster, but I do have every ticket stub. But from the 95 series, wow, I don't have anything really that stands out. I have the tickets there, but I will give you, you talked about 04, and I'll tell you a quick story. I was sitting in the upper deck in right field in St. Louis at Busch Stadium the night that the Red Sox broke the 86-year streak. And Jason Isringhausen was getting ready to pitch. I'm pretty sure it was the eighth inning. And he's warming up directly below me. I'm in the front row in right field. And he just tosses this ball up, right? And it's coming at me. And it's knuckling. And it's moving to my left. And I'm right-handed. And I reached out with all of the stretch that I could, my Willie McCovey, you know, stretch over here. And I nabbed the ball with my left hand. And wow. I got a special memory from Game 4 of the 2004 World Series.
Nice. That's pretty cool. And I'm assuming you've kept that baseball. You didn't do like I did when I got the Willie Davis autograph as a kid and go out and play catch during mud season in front of a sugar house.
No, I have a little shrine. I can actually take a picture of it and tweet it out later. It's in a little case, and it looks very lovely in my office sitting right in front of me.
All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, here we go. Week 33, gentlemen. This franchise last appeared in the World Series during the administration of President Ronald Reagan. Was it the Reds, the Brewers, the Pirates, or the Athletics? Last appeared in the World Series during the Reagan administration. Reds, Brewers, Pirates, or A's?
All right, what you got?
I'm going to go Brewers.
I'm going to go Brewers, too.
Oh, you're both in rare form over here. Yes. Both correct. 1982. Yes.
Combining two of my very few strengths, being able to remember in sequence who won the World Series and the other being someone who loves U.S. history. And so I was able to get that one. Taylor, I don't know how you got it, but that was impressive. I thought you were going to blow that one.
I appreciate that. I don't know. It was kind of a guess. I knew that the A's had been in the World Series. Throwing darts at a wall. I've just been lucky this season. I'm blowing the lid off my secret here, but that's it.
I can't stand it. Now he's going all humble on us after he's won the title. I'm a little embarrassed. I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. All right, Todd, thanks for doing this.
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Rob Manfred was on with Keyshawn, J. Will, and Zubin in the morning, answering questions about the state of baseball. First off, he was asked for his reaction to Jeff Luhnow's latest comments, in which Luhnow distanced himself from the sign-stealing scandal.
The 22,000 electronic messages that Jeff talked about over and over again were a fraction of the evidence in the case. There was a lot of other evidence, electronic, testimonial, which indicated Jeff's culpability in this matter. Secondly, whether he exactly knew what was going on or not is really beside the point. After the Apple Watch incident, I wrote to all the GMs. I put them on notice that it was their obligation to make sure that their organizations were not violating any of the sign-stealing rules. I think it's pretty clear from the facts that Mr. Luhnow failed to discharge that obligation. He damaged the game, and as a result, he was disciplined.
He was asked about how baseball flattened the curve and finished the season.
The three most important words in our game are great players. They have done a phenomenal job altering the way they play the game on the field and the way they live their lives in order to adhere to the protocols, keep themselves healthy, keep the game on the field. Obviously, a lot of support from club people, umpires, my staff. But, you know, at the end of the day, as is always the case in our game, it's about the players.
He was asked about how concerned he was at the start of the 60-game season.
We had some very nervous days early on. Obviously, well documented the issues we had with the Marlins and the Cardinals. Obviously, when you're talking about people's health, you have to be cautious. And it was a genuine concern for me.
He was asked about baseball's expectations at the beginning of the season.
The beginning of the season was not a great chapter for the game. I am sorry that we subjected our fans to that, but it was a very, very difficult situation. I think some of the expectations as to what could be accomplished in the context of the pandemic were just too high. And we did resist the temptation to try to bite off too much got to, I think, a season that was reasonable and obviously one that we were able to complete.
He was asked about the relationship between the Player Association and Major League Baseball.
I think that, you know, it's important to take the perspective. Labor relations, you're going to have your ups and downs. You're not going to see eye to eye on every issue. I think once I announced the 60-game season, the cooperation that we've gotten from Tony and the Players Association has been really, really good. They helped us tremendously after the initial outbreaks in terms of tightening the protocols and you know, speaking to players, encouraging players how important it was to adhere to those protocols. And then, you know, later on in the summer, they agreed with us that we should get into a single site, you know, bubble type format for the postseason. We were able to reach that agreement. Work through the logistics of that were really difficult and, you know, required additional sacrifice for players. So, you know, we've had great cooperation from the union once we got going.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Friday. And first up, I got to ask you, you had a little downtime yesterday. How'd you spend it, man?
What are you kidding? Downtime. No, the downtime comes a little bit later today because we got college football tomorrow at ESPN. But yesterday I wound up doing TV, three different shows, did the pod. I think I did six radios. It was a busy day yesterday. And I watched the debate last night.
Okay. All right. So I was looking for something non-baseball related. So debate.
Yeah, I watched the debate and okay. We probably should leave it at that.
All right. Let's move on here. Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit writes in, do you think the Dodgers regret not throwing Kershaw an extra inning in game one so they could preserve an extra inning on their bullpen?
No, Mitchell, I don't think so. And I'll tell you why, because on Thursday you had the off day. I think both managers were aggressive with their bullpens in game two, knowing that they would have 48 hours before the next game.
Next up, PK Steinberg, another Dodgers pitching question. He writes in, the Dodgers pitching Wednesday night looks A, like the Rays approach, B, failed miserably, and C, even with a day off, burned how many guys?
Yeah, PK, I think it didn't go well. And I think one of the questions going forward is, if in fact we get to a game six, how will the Dodgers handle that next quote-unquote bullpen game? You know, will they go with Dustin May? Will they go with Tony Gonsolin? You know, my amateur read on it, watching those two guys, is that they look like young pitchers who might be in and over their skis. And I am curious to see if Dave decides, you know what, let's go with the old pro, Alex Wood, in game six.
Last one for the week, Daniel Beck at GTB writes in, Buster, you expressed incredulity about Luhnow's claim about ignorance of cheating. I'm with you. Shouldn't we have the same skepticism about Crane?
I don't think so. Just knowing owners, they do tend to, you know, not be in the weeds, you know, moment to moment with teams. And so if you told me that Jim Crane didn't have any personal knowledge, that wouldn't surprise me. I think what Jim Crane does need to own, though, is the tanking strategy. You know, he's distanced himself from that. Like, no, that wasn't what we're doing. Of course it was. And also, I remember that first press conference last winter when he was asked whether or not the 17 championship was tainted. And he said, no, and I'm paraphrasing, no, not at all. Of course it was. Of course it is. And it's going to go down in history as tainted. And there's nothing they can do to change that. And I think it would be important for folks with other teams if he acknowledged that.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Please subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. Enjoy the games this weekend, everyone.
That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Jake, to Chris, to Todd, and to Taylor. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Enjoy the World Series. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.